The following podcast contains audio extracted from videos on the Harry Potter Theory YouTube channel. Hey everyone, welcome to another installment of Harry Potter Theory. Today we're going to be answering some questions about the Harry Potter series that a lot of people probably don't know the answers to. From little tidbits to what may seem like major oversights, this video will cover them all. I'm going to cover 5 today, and if you like this series, then I'll keep making more. Just let me know in the comments. Anyway, let's dive into it. What happens when a Quidditch player, other than the Seeker, catches the Golden Snitch? Quidditch is the most popular sport in the Wizarding World, and it involves 2 teams flying on broomsticks, attempting to score goals by throwing a ball through hoops, while also trying to catch a small, flying object called the Golden Snitch. The positions, put incredibly simply, are keepers, who defend goals, chasers, who score goals, beaters, who protect teammates, and lastly, seekers, who are responsible for catching the Golden Snitch. And in the Harry Potter series, we mostly see players keep to their own positions. But one hypothetical did cross my mind. What happens if a player, other than the Seeker, catches the Golden Snitch? Well, as it turns out, this is accounted for in the official rules. When a Quidditch player other than the Seeker catches or touches the Golden Snitch, it is considered a foul known as Snitch Nip. And apparently, if a player commits a Snitch Nip, their team forfeits the entire game. To me, this does present an entirely new strategy for Quidditch that can be employed by teams. If it forces the opposing team to forfeit, why not purposely try and get the opposing team's players hit by the snitch? Easier said than done, I suppose. Why was Tom Riddle the heir of Slytherin if he wasn't a pureblood? In the Chamber of Secrets, the title The Heir of Slytherin refers to an individual who possesses the ability to open the Chamber of Secrets and control the basilisk within. And later on in the book, it's revealed that the heir is in fact Lord Voldemort, aka Tom Riddle. Surprise, surprise. But what's odd about this is that Tom Riddle had a Muggle father. And why is this a problem? Well, because that would make him a half-blood. And you see, the very founder of Slytherin House, Salazar Slytherin, was a pure-blood wizard who despised anyone that wasn't also pure of blood. So how could it be that Tom Riddle is the true heir to the man that would never have approved of his blood status? The first thing that's important to note is that being an heir does not necessarily require pure-blood status. In the case of Tom Riddle, his connection to Slytherin came from his ability to trace his ancestry back to the Gaunt family, who were known for their strong ties to the Slytherin lineage. Merope Gaunt, Tom Riddle's mother, was a descendant of Salazar Slytherin himself, making Tom Riddle the last living heir of Slytherin at the time. It's also worth considering that although Tom Riddle was not a pure-blood wizard, he still aligned himself with upholding the ideals and traditions associated with the Slytherin bloodline. Would Salazar Slytherin himself have approved of Tom Riddle's blood status? Not necessarily. But does Riddle's shared bloodline with Salazar make him the only possibility for an heir? Absolutely. Why could Umbridge conjure a Patronus? Dolores Umbridge was a powerful witch, there's no denying that. But the fact remains that she was certainly crueler than she was powerful. In fact, Umbridge may have been one of the most malevolent forces in the entire series. Which makes me wonder what business she had casting a Patronus charm. A Patronus is a spell representative of a positive energy force that produces a magical animal guardian which protects against dementors and other dark forces. And it's famous for its representation of light, happiness, and purity. We're taught time and time again that it's a skill reserved for the pure of heart. We even learned of what happens to wizards that aren't pure of heart who try to produce it in the tale of Ruxidian. So how could Umbridge, who is basically pure evil, muster the necessary emotions to cast such a spell? While there is a widespread and justified belief that a wizard who is not pure of heart cannot produce a successful Patronus, a rare few witches and wizards of questionable morals have succeeded in producing the charm. Dolores Umbridge, for example, is able to conjure a cat Patronus to protect herself from dementors. It may be that a true and confident belief in the rightness of one's actions can supply the necessary happiness. However, most such men and women, who become desensitized to the effects of the dark creatures with whom they may ally themselves, regard the Patronus as an unnecessary spell to have in their arsenal. What this suggests about the Patronus charm is that, if the witch or wizard's moral compass is so broken and twisted that they have deluded themselves into thinking that they're doing the right thing, then there is no reason that they wouldn't be able to cast a Patronus. How did Bill Weasley and Fleur Delacour meet? Bill Weasley and Fleur Delacour get together in the Harry Potter series and eventually marry. However, their relationship seemed to progress quite quickly, and some fans have been left scratching their heads as to how Bill and Fleur's relationship came to be in the first place. Bill was Ron's much older brother, and Fleur was a participant in the Triwizard Tournament from France. As it turns out, Bill and Fleur first encounter each other in June of 1995 during the Triwizard Tournament. Bill shows up to the tournament with his mother to support Harry and cheer him on. It is said that Fleur was instantly intrigued by him and observed him from afar. However, their relationship didn't properly blossom until much later, when Bill got a job at Gringotts. Coincidentally, Fleur had also taken up a part-time role at the bank to enhance her language skills, and this is where the pair hit it off. This is referenced by the Weasley twins in The Order of the Phoenix. Remember old Fleur Delacour? She's got a job at Gringotts to improve her English, and Bill's been giving her a lot of private lessons. Did Lily intentionally cast her loving sacrifice? One of the most famous and powerful spells in the Harry Potter series is Sacrificial Protection, a powerful and excessively long-lasting spell that protected infant Harry from Voldemort. In fact, it was the only reason he was able to survive Voldemort's killing curse and to become the boy who lived. For, at the mere age of one, Harry was able to walk away from the Avada Kedavra curse thanks, in no small part to his mother, Lily Potter, sacrificing her own life in an effort to protect her son. From what we know, on that cold and dark evening in 1981 on October 31st, in the Potter's home in Godric's Hollow, Voldemort came hunting for Harry, known only to him as the infant wizard prophesied to be his downfall. And when Voldemort came face to face with Lily Potter, who was all that stood between the Dark Lord and Harry, Voldemort commanded her to stand aside, which of course she did not. Despite Lily's refusal to get out of the way, Voldemort cast his Avada Kedavra curse as he had done so many times before, killing countless other powerful witches and wizards, including James Potter just minutes before. And yet this time, Lily, desperate to save her baby boy, threw herself in front of Harry to protect him. And protect him she did, because her act of throwing herself in between her child and the Avada Kedavra curse invoked the ancient magic of the Sacrificial Protection spell, which then bounced the killing curse back to the Dark Lord, rendering him a shadow version of himself for the better part of the 10 years that followed. But did Lily do all of this intentionally? Did she really know what her loving sacrifice would accomplish? Did she really think it would protect Harry? Here's the thing, and let me be real. Up to that point, no one had accomplished anything like what Lily had just accomplished. Voldemort was thought to be untouchable, and magic like Sacrificial Protection was just so many levels above any other spell in the Wizarding World. So could she have known exactly what it would accomplish? Did she know for certain that it would save Harry? She can't have, but what she did believe in was her selfless love for Harry, and it's this belief in the selfless act that causes Sacrificial Protection to be cast. It was her love for him that fueled the magic of the spell and made it particularly potent. She chose to stay and die, despite the odds that her sacrifice wouldn't make any difference. All she could think about was shielding her son in that moment. And, as destiny would have it, it was that very choice to die when her life was not in jeopardy that indeed made all the difference. And that's it for this video. What do you guys think? Do you want more of these videos? Let me know down in the comment section below. Until next time, remember, it does not do to dwell on dreams, and forget to live.